We're going to call the meeting to order. Looks like we have a quorum. And I believe there's a... We're going to move the minutes. Representative Abler moves the minutes. Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Amendments adopted. And then today we have the dental day. Looks like there's a lot of folks who are interested in this topic here. I'm going to go over there to present, and Representative Murphy will chair. And I think before we start, we have a presentation or something? Introduction? Oh, okay. Before we move ahead, I'm going to establish the ground rules before I give the chair up to Representative Murphy. The ground rules are, there's going to be the presentation of the bill, and then each side will have 30 minutes to present their case, and then we'll open up for questions. Looks like a lot of the members already know the bills left and right. Read all of them already. And then we'll do the, I want the chair to keep pretty good track of time. We're going to give each group 30 minutes. And then we're going to go to questions, and after that we're going to vote. And then move on to the second bill. So, Aaron?
Good evening, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Representative South.
Madam Chair.
I think we're going to begin with a presentation from the Department of Health.
Okay, we'll take the presentation first, and then we'll do the bill. This is a 5-minute presentation.
3 minutes.
3 minutes. Very good.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Mark Schoenbaum. I'm from the Minnesota Department of Health. And just to set the stage a little bit, kind of bring you up to date from last session, last year's legislature assigned the health department to lead the work group that you had created to develop recommendations to implement your 2008 oral health practitioner legislation. We did that, and we believe we did it well, and we wanted to thank you for the opportunity. The work group that you created met 8 times between August and December and produced recommendations as well as draft legislation. 13 stakeholders from the groups that you identified in last year's law participated actively. Staff supported their work with background research. The group also contributed their own substantial expertise, including expertise from both MNSCU and the University of Minnesota. Input from the public was also collected and shared. Many of the group's decisions were made by consensus. Some were made by majority vote. Some of those votes were close. Some were not. The recommendations and all the deliberations of the work group are completely and extensively documented in this 117-page work group report, which I believe many of you are familiar with. The work groups cover, broadly speaking, requirements to practice in underserved areas, educational requirements and testing, licensure and regulatory requirements, scope of practice and level of supervision, the economic impacts of oral health practitioners, and the evaluation of the effects of oral health practitioners. 54 procedures were approved by the work group to be included in the scope. 40 of them were approved by at least 10 of the 13 members. Most other votes were 8 to 5, as were most of the votes to allow general supervision. At the end of last session, we at the Health Department were told to expect all decisions to be made by votes of 7 to 6. So we were pleased to find more agreement in the work group than had been expected. In summary, the department led the work group through a very valid process. That process produced a valid set of recommendations that provide you and the legislature a solid foundation for your further work. Thank you.
Members, are there questions for Mr. Schoenbaum? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 1226, recommend to pass and be referred to the Health Human Service Policy Committee.
All right, members, Representative Powell moves House File 1226 to be recommended to pass and to be advanced to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I won't go too much into this bill. Many of you guys already know what the bill is about. This is the result of many, many months of work by a lot of professionals in their field. And I know that there was not a unanimous agreement. However, there was. This is the result of the working group that went over the summer and travel, I think, to several countries to get these information to get to this point. I'll give a little reason why as to why I'm carrying this bill. And as you know, in committee, you hear over and over about the lack of access to dental care, especially in the urban core and the rural areas. And all of you guys know that this year the budget, we're in a pretty tight deficit. And even in good years, I don't think we're going to get an increase in dental reimbursement. So, as the chair, I would like to see if we could do something to address access. And this is the result, and I'm honored to carry the proposal. With me, I have Mr. Skandick, who's going to explain the provision.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Skandick.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Michael Skandick, and I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition. And the coalition is made up of different organizations, clinics, healthcare providers, safety net hospitals, all of whom have one thing in common. They serve primarily low-income, uninsured, and disadvantaged patients, a lot of Medicaid patients, people with disabilities or socioeconomic barriers. The Safety Net Coalition got interested in this issue a few years back. We had been working primarily on medical side healthcare issues, but it percolated up among all our members, even those that are do mental health services, the hospitals, and others, that lack of access to dental care had become an issue for everyone to the point where the Safety Net Coalition felt that it was one of our top priorities to try to deal with that problem. An example I like to give is the Minnesota Association of the Community Mental Health Centers. They had done a survey of the people that they serve in the mental health centers to ask them what their concerns were. And one of the top concerns that was reported back to them is their inability to get treatment for dental problems that they had. And so even the mental health clinics see this as a very important priority for the safety net providers. As you all know, there was a bill last year that passed that laid the groundwork for the legislation before you. There were some issues that weren't resolved at the end in terms of scope of practice and supervision and education requirements. And so you all, as Representative Tao mentioned, created a work group, and I was served on that work group. And I will say both that we did an exhaustive job and an exhausted job of going through in detail the scope of practice, the programs of other countries, the research that's out there, And unfortunately, we weren't able to reach a unanimous agreement on the recommendations, but we did have good, solid support. And the recommendations of the work group are before you in the bill that you're looking at today. Probably don't need to go through the bill section by section because most of the pages are technical changes that are making amendments to various existing laws that relate to licensed professions. So what I'm going to do is just explain what the bill does and not go through in agonizing detail section by section. What the bill does is authorize what would be called an oral health practitioner. The oral health practitioner would be required to be supervised by a dentist. They would have to have a written agreement with the dentist in which the dentist would determine what they are allowed to do and authorize their practice. The law constrains what they can do, but the dentist can further constrain that based on their judgment of what the oral health practitioner is required to do. There are several different education programs being proposed, all of which would have a minimum of a bachelor's degree. The program proposed by the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities would be a master's level degree. Also, the bill limits the practice of the oral health practitioners to safety net settings where there's a lack of access to dental care. We're not trying to create this as a primarily a private sector or public and private, but we're focusing on the areas where the safety net providers who provide dental care have found that they're unable to get dentists to practice in their clinics. Now, originally this was a safety net coalition proposal, but as we moved forward, we began to hear from a lot of other groups, and one example is the nursing homes, who also have been unable to get dentists to treat their patients in the nursing home, and so they have joined our coalition, and we have some here to testify on that issue as well. So what we try to do is really focus on the places where access is a problem, where people can't get treatment for their dental problems, limit the practice to those settings, require the supervision of a dentist. We're also requiring in the bill that the oral health practitioner would have to pass a competency examination. They would be subject to licensure. They would have to have periodic reviews of their quality of care by the supervising dentist. And then also the entire program would be subject to an evaluation after it passes to review the quality of care that's being provided, look at the impact on access and on cost of care. And so that's the overview of what the bill does. I know that there's been a lot of phone calls and emails and messages left for you, and I know this is a really difficult issue. It's a major change. We can understand why people would be nervous about that change. But what we're going to try to do tonight is reassure you that the bill that's before you is not uncharted territory. It is very well researched, and we have a lot of experience of 52 other countries that have done this before, some of whom have up to 80 or more years of experience doing this. There's also a large body of research evidence that supports that this model that we're considering here will improve access, that it will provide quality care, and that the safety of patients will be protected. And I just want to finally, just a couple of things that we've heard from legislators that they've heard about it, is that this is an unsupervised practitioner. We want to tell you we've never supported an unsupervised practitioner. We've always wanted to have the dentist be in a relationship where they're supervising and responsible for the oral health practitioner. We also wanted to make sure, some people have heard that this is just a two-year program in mind, and we just want to clarify that's 2 years after you have a bachelor's degree. It's really a master's program that's being proposed, not a two-year program. And finally, I think people have said this is the first time that this has been done anywhere in the world. And we have evidence here before you today, people from other parts of the world that have done this for a long time and have experience in it. They're going to talk to you about their experiences with the program. So I think that concludes my testimony, and we'd be ready to hear the rest of our witnesses unless I have any questions from the members.
Thank you, Mr. Scandrett. Other questions from members? All right, then I'm grateful to see people joining us at the witness table. I just want to remind members that, as I understand it, we're going to have 30 minutes for the proponents, 30 minutes for the opponents, and I also think we're going to, before we go to a vote, we're going to hear Representative Norton's bill as well. And then vote on both proposals at the end. That's what I have been told is the game plan. So, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ron Nagel. I'm a doctor with the Alaska Area Dental Program. I'm responsible for the federal oral health activities in the state of Alaska, and I'm also designated as a consultant for the Alaska Tribal Program. Thank you for inviting me. I'm not here today to advocate on any particular legislation, but rather to provide information about our program in Alaska. I've worked with dental therapists in the Western Pacific for 6 years, and with the dental therapists who are currently practicing in Alaska for the past 4 years. I'm the principal investigator for a Kellogg Foundation grant aimed at developing dental therapists for the tribal programs in Alaska in collaboration with the School of Medicine at the University of Washington. There are 14 dental therapists who are currently practicing and another 14 therapists in training in Alaska, and I'm responsible for the curriculum development, training, and certification of these new providers. Just a little bit about the training programs. Our first three cohorts of dental therapists, called dental health aid therapists, graduated from Otago University in New Zealand before returning to Alaska. In 2006, the Alaska tribes began their own program, training dental therapists, and that was the first of its kind in the country. Dental schools are not the only places that can provide education for dental therapists or the OHP. The Canadian Dental Program and our own Alaska-based dental therapy programs are examples of models that are not taught in a dental school. These are cost-effective two-year programs. The legislation that you're looking at is actually much more lengthy in terms of the length of training. Identifying students who are connected to their communities and are proven has been proving more important to us than who does the training. So getting students to return back to their communities is just really what this program is all about. The development of an Alaska-based education program has not created a two-tiered system or a lower quality of care. It's enabled us to better tailor the training to meet the needs of our patients and bring the training closer to home so that our students have better retention rates. The safety net providers who have primary responsibility for the OHP really ought to be the ones involved in the training and construction of the curriculum to ensure that these providers will meet the needs of the patient populations that they serve. And in our case, those same people have proven to be the best instructors for our program. So with these things in mind, I urge you to enact legislation that will allow multiple venues for training in the OHP program. Supervision is another issue that continues to come up, and we discussed this quite a bit with our Alaska program. In 2008, I collaborated on a paper that was published in the International Dental Journal examining the practice of dental therapy in 52 other countries. In nearly every case, dental therapists provide their services under general supervision without the dentist being present at the time of the procedure. Expanding access and creating a safety net by necessity calls for the establishment of more entry points into the oral health care system. So in order for the OHP to be successful, they have to practice their scope in communities and in populations where there are no dentists under general supervision. Clinical guidance is the professional support and assistance provided to dental therapists or the OHP by their supervising dentist as part of the provision of overall integrated care. And our counterparts in medicine and dental therapy programs have proven that clinical guidance can occur at a distance as long as there's an appropriate mechanism in place to facilitate that exchange. So in practical terms, dentists have to recognize the OHP as a skilled practitioner, and that oversight is really accomplished by periodic reviews of clinic records and other patient-related factors in quality assurance. Competency and quality assurance continue to be discussed as we talk about new providers. I think there's good reason for that. We looked at the evidence before we began our program in Alaska, and there's no evidence to support claims that the services provided by dental therapists are unsafe or of poor quality. Virtually all of the existing literature suggest just the opposite. And my own firsthand experience in the Western Pacific and in Alaska confirmed for me that dental therapists are safe, effective, and they provide high-quality care where it is needed. Making references to oral health care procedures as irreversible surgical procedures is really a scare tactic, I think, that detracts quite a bit from the discussions surrounding the development of new providers or addressing quality issues. Everyone should be concerned with the quality of care of new providers, but the only way to monitor quality is through an ongoing quality assurance program that evaluates performance over time. Altering the scope or supervision of a practitioner does not assure quality. Dental therapists in Alaska, too, participate in their regional quality assurance programs and are held to the exact same standards that dentists are for those services that they provide. And so that can be a model for any place that develops new providers. Issues surrounding the scope of practice. Dental therapy is a discrete healthcare discipline with a defined scope of practice, and I believe the OHP will be the same thing. The oral health needs of the population to be served should be the primary guiding factor in determining the scope and supervision needed for your new providers. Dental therapy training in Alaska is an intensive 2-year program that focuses on clinical competency. And comparably, students in our program perform comparably large numbers of procedures during their training to dental students in their training. An important emphasis in the design of education programs for these providers should be aimed at solidifying providers' ability to recognize their scope of practice and perform as part of an integrated team, requesting consultations and making referrals when appropriate. If these elements are built into the curriculum, this will enable the OHP and other providers to operate under general supervision. Just to summarize, to increase capacity, new providers like the OHP should operate under general supervision and create more entry points into the oral health care system. Their scope is important, and important elements to the safety net, and these should include the ability to address pain, infection, and function of teeth. We're talking about extractions and fillings, in addition to the preventive measures. So these minimally invasive procedures are so important to our patients that there's simply no support for a program that doesn't address these. And if we're truly concerned about quality, a program should employ a quality assurance program to address those issues. Non-traditional educational venues can really offer some distinct benefits in preparing and supporting these new providers. So I encourage you to consider those. Thank you for your invitation to participate in this hearing and share some of our experiences in Alaska. Please call on me if I can be of any further help, and consider coming to Alaska to see our dental therapy program. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Nagel. Members, other questions? Please proceed. Please welcome to the committee and introduce yourself.
Madam Chairman and committee members, my name is Tim Torbert, and I'm a semi-retired public health dentist, graduated from the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry in 1962. We figured it out this afternoon. That's 47 years. And I also got a degree in a master's in public health in 1972. Have also been training dental therapists for the past 15 years at the National School of Dental Therapy in the province of Saskatchewan. Supervised and utilized dental therapists for the past 25 years. Ideally, the ones that I've been dealing with were trained at the dental school, at the dental therapy school, for remote communities. That means they were trained to work on the children from 9 until 3 in the afternoon, at which time they would pick up the adults for emergency treatment. Dental therapists have been practicing in Saskatchewan, the province I'll talk to you the most because we have the most of them, for the past 35 years, and they've been self-regulated. As members of a multidisciplinary dental therapist provide restorative dental treatment, disease prevention, oral health promotion programs, and advocate for the needs of clients assisting them in accessing care and refer clients to other professionals for services beyond their scope. Dental therapists can legally provide all services within their scope of practice, including, but not limited to, examinations, diagnosis of decay, local anesthetics, radiographs, routine restorations or fillings, and extractions of both primary and permanent teeth that are uncomplicated, and also pulpotomies and stainless steel crowns. These services can be provided in are provided in public and in private practice settings under what is called a consultative referral relationship with the dentist, commonly referred to as a general supervision. About 130 dental therapists are employed by or work with a contract dentist in private practice. That means in the cities of Saskatoon and in Regina, private practitioners are using about 130 of our dental therapists who have leaked off from the public health program. Patient safety, if there was a concern about competency or patient safety or the quality of service provided by dental therapists, we would have received complaints from those dentists that are supervised by or associated with. Until last year, no dental therapist had ever been cited for professional misconduct or professional incompetency. In 2007, a dental therapist was found guilty of professional misconduct, and I'm still ticked off. What happened? He was one of my students, and he had come to us from Poland as a qualified dentist. Then we took him on, and he became a dental therapist. And once he left the school, he refused to confine himself to that. So you can understand why we're a little upset at the little dental therapist who has made us one black mark. All dental therapists are required to maintain an independent malpractice insurance. There has never been an insurance claim against a dental therapist's independent professional ability. I might add at the same time, that cost each and every dental therapist $205 a year for their malpractice. I pay more than that for a month of malpractice. Does the insurance company know something that I don't know or that we don't know? A curriculum review carried out by the College of Dentistry at the University of Saskatchewan, which is an accredited dental college, showed that dental therapists are trained to do at least the same level of competency or greater than the dental students for the same competencies within their shared scopes of practice. The number of hours, both didactic and clinically, are not only comparative, they're exceeded in both clinical and in the practice, both didactic and clinical, that dental students are taking. And they must demonstrate their competencies more often in their training than dental students. In closing, I'd kind of like to say that each and every dental therapy program around the world has developed a target population. And if you really want to see how to work it out with school-based kids, because your school kids have a bad DMF rate, check out the New Zealand and the Australian premises. And if you're looking for how to do it in remote areas, come on up to Canada, where you're still having fun. You're looking at a dentist who's had, I consider myself the luckiest dentist and the happiest dentist that I know. And it's all because of 25 years working with dental therapists. And I get a little irritated when I'm constantly hearing about competency and safety, you know. I get irritated at the fluoride people who keep, the anti-fluoride people who keep repeating the same thing year after year after year. And since 1926, we've proven that dental therapists have great competency and they're safe to deal with. And in closing, the reason, real reason you can listen and pay attention is my dad comes from Hector, Minnesota, and my mother comes from Grenada, Minnesota. And I just turned 75. Thank you very much.
Indeed, Dr. Torbert, it's really nice to meet the luckiest dentist in the world. As you're getting ready to testify and welcome to the committee, I just want to remind those that are yet to come as proponents that we have about 15 minutes left now of time for testimony, so if you can think about skinning back your testimony just a little bit, that would be great. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shelley Guest, and I'm the director of the Advancing Children's Dental Health Initiative for the Pew Center on the States. I worked for the National Conference of State Legislatures for 9 years, so you were my bosses for a long time, and I remember how many groans I would hear whenever anything related to workforce or scope of practice came up. So my sympathy, I know it's difficult. Dental care is the most prevalent unmet need among children. Dental problems impair children's ability to learn, play, and interact with their families and peers. Enduring dental pain from untreated cavities is unimaginable to most of us for even a day, let alone for weeks or months, but that is the reality for many low-income children. Some problems may be intractable. This one is not, and that's why Pew is working on it now. The legislation you are considering would create a new primary care dental professional similar to those used in Alaska and 52 countries around the world. This professional would strengthen dental care just as nurse practitioners and physician assistants have strengthened medical care. The safety, quality, and effectiveness of these people is well established. Rigorous research shows they perform their duties as competently as dentists. Access to dental care for low-income children has been a vexing and persistent problem. Overall, the problem of poor dental health falls disproportionately on the poor. 80% of pediatric dental disease is concentrated in 25% of children, primarily those from low-income and minority households. And most people don't understand that there really is no safety net for dental care. There are no dental emergency rooms. But the bedrock of what we do have is community health centers. However, nationally, only 1 in 10 people who lack access to dental care can get it from the safety net provider. There's just not enough capacity. Almost 20% of positions for dentists in community health centers are vacant because there isn't anybody willing to go there and work. So these new professionals could greatly increase capacity for underserved people. In all states, there's a shortage of dentists who can treat young children. There are way too few dentists in rural areas and low-income urban areas and who will accept Medicaid and CHIP. So clearly more needs to be done, and this is a real step in the right direction. As you've heard from Ron Nagel and from Ken Torbert, around the world there are many countries and parts of the industrialized world where they use dental therapists and they've had many, many decades of good results. They complete a rigorous 2-year training program that's similar to the last 2 years of dental school, except they study fewer procedures. They focus on patient-centered care rather than provider-centered care for both adults and for children. Around the world, though, some countries are moving towards an oral health practitioner model that is 3 years, and it combines dental therapy with dental hygiene into one, and the legislation you're considering today is similar to that. So, obviously, as you know, regulation of the health profession falls squarely on the shoulders of state policymakers. But the goal of regulation is not just to ensure the safety of the public, it's also to ensure the public has access to care. So when you make these decisions, you have to be balancing the costs and the benefits for both safety and for access. So the main question to answer here is, how will these new providers be used and how will they fit into the healthcare system? If they're to be used in underserved areas, then they can function a hub and spoke system with supervising dentists at the hub and new providers a phone call and an internet hookup away from a real-time consult. This is 2009, when technology means that supervision does not have to be on site to work. So my recommendation is that there should be general supervision under standing orders. This is not a safety issue and will in no way put patients at risk. Under general supervision, these new providers will have specific instructions about what cases they can take, what treatment they can provide on their own, which cases they should not take, and a requirement to get approval for any case they're not sure of. Most discussions about dental workforce begin with an assumption that dentists can do anything that their patients require and can do it better than any non-dentist could. But in other countries, the dental therapist training program includes 760 hours of clinical training on treating children. And by comparison, in this country, on average, dental students get 171 hours in pediatric dentistry. So dental therapists are more comfortable and experienced treating children than new dentists getting out of school here. While dentists are trained to clean teeth, a majority employ hygienists to clean their patients' teeth. That means in today's private practices, the first provider who does a diagnosis and sees the patient and provides treatment is the hygienist. So ultimately, these new oral health professionals will become a major source of patient visit for dentists via referral and will allow dentists in clinics and private dental practices to see more patients, to improve their efficiency, and devote more time to more complex procedures. There's a robust body of literature from around the world that shows that providers other than dentists can be taught in short periods to pull teeth and fill cavities with quality and consistency that is equal to that of dentists. If you can teach students who become dentists to perform those services safely, you can definitely teach students who become dental therapists or oral health practitioners to perform them safely. Private practice dentists deliver nearly 90% of the care in this country, and the safety net delivers 10%. So these new primary care providers are intended to bolster the 10%, and they would increase the number of patients who can be cared for in underserved areas. These are vulnerable, low-income children and adults whom most private dentists do not treat. This new position provides a common-sense safety net solution to deliver high-quality care to people who otherwise cannot get it. I urge you to enact legislation to create new providers, and I and the Truth Center on the States are ready to assist you in your efforts. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. And next we have Dr. Hemesworth, or who would please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members, I am Linda Baer. I'm the Senior Vice Chancellor for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I want to first thank the Department of Health for a careful and well-managed job of facilitating the working group process that brought you to this place. We are here to tell you about our innovative academic program that will prepare oral health practitioners to help address the chronic disparities in access to oral health care in Minnesota. This program is the result of more than 3 years of development work. We have drawn on the extensive study and planning work among dental professionals nationally. We've drawn together a program advisory committee of experienced dental and healthcare educators who have taken the professional competencies developed nationally and translated them into an outstanding Master's of Science curriculum. The program has been through extensive review and approval process at the university and at the system level. After reviewing the sample of 52 mid-level provider programs internationally, we find ample confirmation that Minnesota State Colleges and Universities is an appropriate home for this kind of practitioner-focused program. Some of these programs train dental therapists in dental schools. Some trained in freestanding dental therapist schools. Some are trained in university settings. All in all, these educational programs in varied settings all produce graduates who practice safely and effectively. Metropolitan State is fully accredited by our regional accreditor, the Higher Learning Commission of the North Central Association. New programs are never accredited when they begin operation, but rather accreditation review takes place after a program is operated long enough to produce graduates. The report of the Legislative Working Group provides for the Minnesota Board of Dentistry to oversee the program, not to accredit it until a national accrediting body will take action. In closing, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities provides an outstanding long-term delivery system for the future preparation of oral health practitioners. To our university campuses across the state, we will be able to prepare mid-career professionals near where they live and work so that they can continue to practice where it is needed. As always, we are ready to go to work to strengthen Minnesota and to make it work. Now, President Hammersmith will tell you about the program.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, good evening. I'm Sue Hammersmith, and it's my privilege to serve as the president of Metropolitan State University. Metropolitan State is the public comprehensive university charged to serve the seven-county Twin Cities region. The Oral Health Practitioner Program reflects established practice across the industrialized world. However, it is new to Minnesota. Programs like the proposal before you have been running successfully and safely in many nations for decades. The OHP proposal is what the international research and experience in those programs leads to. It incorporates best practices from around the world. Someone else has done the heavy lifting of demonstrating that this model of practice is safe and effective. We have the privilege of implementing a proven model, but only after improving it even further as a Master of Science degree program. To enter this program, applicants must have a bachelor's degree, a dental hygiene license, and 2,400 hours of clinical experience, leading up to an even more rigorous course of graduate study. No other program in the world trains to this level, and yet they are successful. Our students will be trained to a high degree of skill on a focused cluster of procedures in a limited scope of practice. Metropolitan State also has a state-of-the-art simulation center for patient safety, the first in Minnesota. We operate this in collaboration with health partners, just like our current students and many working professionals in the health field who study with us. The OHP students will be fully trained in this facility to respond to medical emergencies. The OHP faculty are all university faculty. They are experienced instructors with demonstrated commitments to practice in public settings. Six of our dental faculty have taught at the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. Their areas of expertise include general, geriatric, pediatric, special needs dentistry, and oral surgery. Two of our faculty supervise dental school graduates in their residencies at Hennepin County Medical Center. We are very proud of the stature of our faculty and of the coursework and the clinical instruction they will deliver. Our students will receive their clinical training in state-of-the-art facilities, including the simulation center. We also will use the fully equipped state-of-the-art facilities at Normandale Community College and at another instructional clinic on St. Paul's east side. The Metropolitan State program is financially sound. We have an exceptionally cost-effective model of instruction, and this program will go forward in spite of the governor's proposed cuts to Minsky's state appropriations. In this difficult economic climate, we are pleased to be able to propose a model that will substantially improve health care access without requiring additional state investment. Metropolitan State University is proud to bring this initiative forward. It is time to move ahead conservatively but confidently and launch the Oral Health Practitioner Initiative in Minnesota. The children are waiting, the elderly are waiting, the community clinics are waiting. Minnesota has a reputation for leadership in progressive public policy. Now is the time to exert that leadership once more. Thank you, Madam Chair. We are available for committee questions.
Thank you, Dr. Hammersmith. And we have just about 2 minutes left for the proponents, so if you want to just come up and talk fast, please. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Craig Amundson. I'm a dentist practicing with Health Partners, where I served as dental director from 1980 to 2008. I had the privilege of representing Minsky on the Oral Health Practitioner Work Group and serve on Metropolitan State University's Oral Health Practitioner Advisory Committee. Speaking for both myself and Health Partners, we fully support this bill. We believe that we'll be able to develop practice opportunities for oral health practitioners as supported by this legislation. We anticipate that they will be valuable members of our oral care delivery team in outreach settings and in medical practice settings with patients who are in need. Our support is based on the fact that this practitioner will be part of the oral health care delivery team. It is contingent upon a robust, comprehensive support structure, collaborative management agreement, and active dentist involvement. The Minnesota Healthcare Transformation Task Force makes recommendations to reduce the overall size and cost of the healthcare system. Specifically, recommends that the state consider modifying licensure of some health professionals to expand their scope in ways that address shortages and allow higher level professionals to practice at the top of their license. This bill appears to be a poster child for that effort. I'd like to make a couple comments about safety and care delivery. Given the robust nature of the curriculum, the educational expertise that resides within the Minnesota State College and University system, and the unique resources of Metropolitan State University possesses, including the Health Partners Simulation Center for Patient Safety, I have full confidence that patients cared for by our oral health practitioners will be treated safely. Further, given that these practitioners will provide care under the direction of a dentist and will practice with specific guidelines with formal review and assessment, I fully expect that the patients treated by these practitioners will be subject to less unexplained variation in clinical decision-making than in our broader practice community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Time for one more.
Madam Chairman and committee members, I'm Jane Turnahaus. I'm a dentist with Appletree Dental, and my patient base is primarily nursing home residents. One of the things that I would like to say is that with an average national statistics show that about 20% of nursing home residents receive one dental visit per year, so that leaves 80% who have no dental care. This is one area where we at Appletree feel the oral health practitioner could be deployed to help work with this population. We currently have served probably over 80 sites in the Twin Cities of long-term care facilities with both our comprehensive care model and under collaborative agreements with hygienists. So we would continue to use that model and expand it further. And I am also on the advisory committee for the MINSQ program, and we at Appletree would support this bill, and we would also be willing to be a clinical site for training for these students.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate everybody's speedy testimony. It's hard. I know I can tell how hard it is. If the committee would indulge us, and if there's no objection, they have one more testifier. I'm seeing nodding and no objecting, so if we could have...
Madam Chair, we have two people that have come down from other parts of the state. We should have put them up first, but I'm wondering, they have been here all day and didn't get to testify in the Senate, and if it would be okay to have those two people, I think. Dr. Taren from HCMC would, I think, defer to our other two folks, if that would be okay with the committee.
And seeing indulgence from the committee, we'll ask them to be brief. Please join us. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for taking time. I thought we were running out of time, so we passed this out. But I'm Sarah Cruz, the Executive Director from Open Door Health Center, and I'm located in Mankato. Our clinic serves the rural part of the state down in South Central Minnesota, so I'm here to offer a bit of a perspective on that. Last year, we saw over 1,700 patients at 4,200 dental visits. We serve more than 10 different counties, Blue Earth, Nicollet, LeSueur, Brown, Watton, Wanwatika being some of the primary places. Our patients are public assistance programs or low-income uninsured. The big concern that we have is when I look at a dental waiting list, I see outstanding need. Between March 1st and 10th, we've already had 74 calls from people that we are not going to get on our schedule during this month. 39 are uninsured. Patients are asked to call at the beginning of each month to stay active on our waiting list. When I compiled three different months between December and February, we had 209 people that we did not get in for care. 42% of them were uninsured. We also work with outreach for Head Start clinics in nine different counties. A third of those kids that we see, you typically see about 1,000 of them, a third of them need some type of follow-up care, and most of the kids are not really getting the care and the follow-up they need. Open Door Health Center has had great difficulty in getting dental providers. For full-time, part-time, or occasional, I'm looking for anyone I can get to come on in and help us out, and we're having a hard time finding that. But we are dedicated to high-quality, safe care, regardless of insurance status. A mid-level dental provider would be a way to increase access for some care for these patients who are not currently being served. I've been very impressed with the work both by those that developed oral health practitioner and the dental therapist recommendations. I would be willing to use a mid-level provider as a member of our dental team, and I would use an Open Door Health Center dentist to supervise that work and ensure safe and quality care. Thank you, committee members, for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Skandret.
Madam Chair, we lost our other person, who was John Bolton from Augustana Nursing Homes, and he was looking forward to speak to you about the problems they're having getting dentists to treat their folks that had to leave early. So I think we'll end it there with and appreciate the indulgence of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Skandret. Appreciate it. And I think we'll just go right ahead into the testimony for those opposed to the legislation. And I'd like to invite you to come on up to the witness table and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair,
welcome
members
the
of the committee. I'm Dr. Scott Lingle. I'm a general dentist here in St. Paul, and I'm speaking for the Minnesota Dental Association, which represents over 80% of the dentists in Minnesota. Dental access is a problem we struggled with for many years. Many things have been done to help, such as the critical access provider programs, collaborative agreements, donated dental services program, volunteer clinics to give kids a smile program. Right now, dentists average over $35,000 a year in charitable dental care for each dentist. And still we have these problems. Last year, we heard that some community clinics were not able to hire enough dentists. So the bill was brought forth to establish an advanced hygiene provider. We oppose this because of an inadequate education and training for a surgical scope of practice that does not have the safety that Minnesota patients deserve. Not much has changed in this bill since the work group. The prerequisite education of a hygiene degree is not the same as a pre-dent or a pre-medicine education. The OHP program is not the same as a dental education. Essentially, you're playing doctor without having to go to doctor school. We can teach people specific skills. You've already heard that, and I agree with that. Any oral surgery educator will tell you that they can teach a dental student or a dental therapist to extract teeth. They will also tell you that they've seen their share of hematomas, facial nerves temporarily paralyzed, missed anesthetic blocks and rip fractures, prolonged post-op bleeding, pain, occasional infections. The mechanics of giving an injection and removing a tooth are only one aspect of care in this situation and can be mastered by the dental student or the therapist student. What requires more complex training and experience is the intellectual aspects of the care. This includes deciding that the tooth needs to be removed, or is there some other treatment that could have saved that tooth? Determining if the patient's health requires modification of the choice of anesthesia, or how the patient needs to be managed in the perioperative period. Assessing the patient's emotional state to decide if local anesthesia alone will handle their pain or anxiety. Knowing what to do if the tooth is not responding to the usual methods used to remove it, or how to manage unexpected problems. The list goes on and on. This is why if you teach someone just to do the mechanics, you need a doctor on site qualified in the intellectual aspects of the care. Before treatment, during treatment, and after treatment. Not a paper supervision where the dentist might not even be in the state while the procedure is being performed. Can the mechanics be taught? Yes, we've heard that. But they should be taught to the same expertise as a dentist. The University of Minnesota is the only school accredited to teach the surgical dental procedures. It is a state-of-the-art facility designed specifically for that, not for teaching only dental hygiene. And it has a faculty that's been fine-tuned for the teaching of dentistry. No other school is designed for that. At the U of M, the therapist would be trained alongside the dentist. They would be part of the dental team from day one. Why would we want to do anything less than that? There are two bills that present a new dental provider. The easy thing to do is to vote for both bills. We all want to do something in the name of access, but doing the easy thing is not always doing the right thing. Minnesota is not a remote tundra like parts of Alaska. We are not a sparsely populated area like northern Saskatchewan. We are Minneapolis and St. Paul, Wilmer and Baudette, different cities, but all within a couple hundred miles of each other. If we need a new member of the dental team, then let's make him or her the best that we can have. The people of Minnesota deserve the same high standard of care, regardless if they are fee-for-service or on public programs. Members of this committee, that's who you represent, the people of Minnesota, not Alaska, not Canada. And so please, you have the opportunity to create a new member of the dental team. Let's do it right. I urge you to defeat House File 1226 and to pass House File 823. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lingle.
My name is Donna Stenberg. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I trained at the University of Minnesota as a dental hygienist in the 70s and then went back to school in the 80s and got my dental degree. I'm a dentist practicing in Stillwater, Minnesota. The proposal before you is really groundbreaking. And I think there would be agreement that you want to start this proposal in an environment for the greatest success and for the greatest quality. The University of Minnesota has been training people with their dental surgical procedures for centuries. They have a proven curriculum, they have a proven faculty, they have the equipment, and they have the patience to be able to train these type of providers. In 1995, one of the Minskew colleges, Century College, started a dental hygiene program. And it was very shaky. It had very strong struggles. It did not have proper instructors. It didn't have the numbers of instructors needed and had financial issues. And to have a program like that where there was a shaky history, the graduates actually, there was a high failure rate for a number of the graduates. So I would urge you to really consider that in starting something like this that is truly groundbreaking for Minnesota, that it be done in an environment where there is a proven history of that training. I think that you want to make sure that you're providing quality to your constituents and also using your financial dollars very wisely. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee. I'm Bruce Templeton. I'm a dentist in Minneapolis, Minnesota, educated in Manitoba and Minnesota. I'm an oral surgeon as well by training. I've been fortunate to be involved in dental education for some 28 years now and did spend my early young years as a general dentist in Canada's far north, working with dental therapists, living in Churchill, and working in the territories called Northwest Territories, then Nunavut, that we call now. I have flown in, spent my time flying in, using the same equipment that the dental therapists use in northern Manitoba, and let me explain a little bit about remote. Remote is when you cannot get your supplies in because the ice hasn't come in and there is no way the ship can come in. Remote is when you can't get to a dentist at all and there are no roads to come to you. And indeed, the dental therapists have worked out to be a very good adjunct to care in the far north where we have no access to dentists to live, to anyone at all. I have lived in Minnesota now since 1983, and we have almost paved roads everywhere and good clinics and access to most places that I find no remote areas. And I do agree with Dr. Torbert. It's a wonderful opportunity to work with these people. I worked on their equipment and used their equipment, and it does work from the morning till 3 in the school to take care of the children and the needs that we need in the remote areas. But there are very few adult care needs that are taken on after 3 o'clock in the remote communities that are involved. We do have a model of a dental therapist program in the Prince Albert School, and it is in Saskatchewan, and it has stayed in Saskatchewan. It's a non-accredited school as far as the other provinces are concerned. And you must know that if this was such a great idea, it would be across the country in all the different provinces in the great laboratory to the north on healthcare, I call, because with our social experience, we really do embrace access and care. But this is state in Saskatchewan and on First Nations lands. For instance, in Manitoba, our closest neighbor to the north, dental therapists cannot work but on First Nations. They are not accredited to work, and they cannot be licensed. The proven model works in situations that we can have support and supervision as regards surgical procedures. As an oral surgeon, I would just like to tell you that I spend my days teaching graduate dentists how to do oral surgery, and we do see certain particular complications in our medically compromised populations in nursing homes, in medically compromised patients with many other comorbidities. It is a challenge. It would be a challenge for people to have these concerns, and the continuous process of diagnosis and treatment planning as we move through a surgical procedure. To that end, I would highly suggest that you consider that on-site supervision be something that would be quite mandatory for someone doing more surgical procedures on adults. I thank you for your time, and I do agree with Dr. Tolbert. It has been a great career, and was a great career being involved with a dental therapist, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Templeton. It seems to me you have a little bit of a brogue in your accent, and it reminds me that it's almost St. Patrick's Day.
A wee bit. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Hi. I'm Dr. Glinder. I'm the dental director for Southside Community Health Services, and I think I'm the public health poster child that's against the OHP proposal. I've been kind of lambasted for speaking out against it. I don't think safety is a foregone conclusion. Actually, David Nass is just publishing in the Journal of Dental Hygiene the study of the 52 programs. The 52 programs are almost all pediatric. And you hear a lot of, when the data is being brought out, they're talking about the pediatric data, and that's pretty much all the research that's been done is pediatric. And so I don't think it's a foregone conclusion on adult extractions and adult surgeries as to the efficacy and safety of that. And that is my concern. When I think a lot of the managers in the public health, you know, the leaders, I'm glad they're here and they're pushing all this, but I think when you talk to people on the other level, everybody's very worried about it. I think we're going to be seeing a lot more issues than I think people have let on to push. I think really you need to be talking to people on this issue. You need to be asking about their mistakes. My mentor, you know, he always talked about all his mistakes when he lectures, and I think that's the best way to go. I know after 10 years of experience, myself, I had 4 years of dental school, and I did 2 years as an AGD, so I did general dentistry for an extra 2 years. And even after 10 years, I couldn't always pick out the ones that were listed as simple. And I know the OHP, the definition for the surgery, has kind of changed. First it was hinted at surgery, then it was simple, and now it's just extraction, so it's left up to that provider. And me, after 4 years of dental school, 2 years of extra training, and then 10 years of public health dentistry, I got into some situations that were, I was way over my head, and that really scares me. I think we need to focus on the pediatrics. I'm fine with doing operatives on doing restorations on adults, but I think when it comes to surgeries, we need to be a little wary of that.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Bob Brandjord. I'm an oral surgeon. I practice with two other oral surgeons in the metropolitan area. We are Medicaid and, yes, Medicare and Minnesota Care providers. We have been that way since our practice started over 30 years ago, and then when Minnesota Care came on, we became a member of Minnesota Care Providers. I'm also a member of the National Advisory Committee on the Evaluation of the Alaska Dental Health Aid Therapist, which is sponsored by four foundations, primarily by the Kellogg Foundation. They're evaluating the 10 DHATs that came, or dental health aid therapists that came in initially, at a cost of about $2 million. It's a very extensive survey that is being done. I'm very much in favor of expanded functions and duties for members of the dental team or new members of the dental team. In fact, I was here a year ago talking about the Community Dental Health Coordinator, the CDHC, and the program that was being proposed. It'd be interesting for you to know that those students have started out in their curriculum, and eventually there will be two in Minnesota because they're part of the training program coming forward, working in Indian Health Service areas in northern Minnesota. The Community Dental Health Coordinator is somebody that is from the community in which they'll serve. They have the same culture, language, and life experience as their patients. And this is the foundation of the success, as Dr. Nagel said, of the dental health aid therapists in Alaska, because they come from that community, they're trusted members of the community, and that's why, honestly, they do so well. And honestly, they have very few complaints because they're part of the community and they can work things out. So, I have a few facts that I would like to share with you about why I would support the University of Minnesota program for dental therapists over this other one. I would like to just state a couple facts. Even with an outline or syllabus or of a curriculum, there are oftentimes omissions that can be very serious within a curriculum unless it has been taught many times over by people who are familiar with it. An example of this is when the initial dental health aid therapist came back from New Zealand, it was found that they did not have the appreciation of dosing of local anesthesia for patients. This can be a serious problem because dosing is by weight. And when you're doing that with children, it is a significant issue, and there have been deaths from overdose of local anesthesia. So that's one issue, but that was found, and that's okay. And now it's been corrected. But what we have to do is, how do we know what things were omitted? We need an institution that has taught dental education to start out in this new adventure. And also, I think that expanding the scope or training should occur within the dental school, which has the knowledge, skills, and ability of training these expanded functions because they're accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation for exactly teaching those type of skills. Even with appropriate care from primary care dental providers, whether it be general dentists or whatever, there still are issues that can arise that require special care and even hospitalization. It has been mentioned a lot about taking care of nursing home people or elderly people who have a number of comorbidities. I would like you to walk along with me week to week as I see some of these people. I discharged a lady from Fairview Ridges Hospital on Monday afternoon who admitted over the weekend with a facial cellulitis that was very extensive and had to be hospitalized for intravenous antibiotics after they had had appropriate care to open a tooth for a root canal. That's one of the scope of practice issues I think that should be considered. The same thing happened the week before, but it was at a different hospital, Queen of Peace Hospital in New Prague, where we had the person admitted. Again, it's not just a simple procedure. It is a complex procedure because of the medical comorbidities. So I think looking at some of the scope of practice issues which are brought up are very, very important. I would also, when I look at some of these issues that have come up across time and I hear people say, well, there have never been any issues, that's because they have some backup for them. In Alaska, where they're out remotely working, I was up and visited Dr. Nagel, I think, over 4 years ago now, I think it was, and they have a beautiful system of teledentistry where they can send pictures and x-rays back to the dentist in Anchorage to evaluate the situation before the treatment is rendered. So there's different ways of handling things, and they do an excellent job with that. I also want you to remember one thing, and this is very important, that dental disease is preventable. Dental disease is preventable. Remember that. We have to focus on prevention. In fact, in countries where we've had the dental health aid therapists, including Canada and New Zealand, when you look at the rate of decay has not substantially dropped when there are dental therapists there. The rate has not dropped. So I would mention three things that I want you to consider. The scope of practice, that it doesn't put patients at risk, and that the level of supervision is appropriate. Training is appropriate in quality facilities with quality educators who have the experience. And remember, dental disease is preventable. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Madam member of the chair, my name is Dr. Kuvain. I practice just down the road, you know, the old Section 4 building. I'm the new proud owner of the old Section 4.
Congrats.
And one of the three more dentists in St. Paul or in Minnesota. And also member of the Minnesota Air National Guard for the last 10 years with the rank of the Lieutenant Colonel. It's still going strong, so.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you. And over the 10 years that I've been practicing, I see over 20,000 patients. Two out of three patients are low-income people, MA or even with the no insurance. And everybody coming to my clinic, they deserve the same care, even the poor or the rich. For example, right now I have a associate, you know, and when my patient walks in the door, if he knew how long he'd been a dentist, I say 3 months. He said, oh, no. I want you So everybody, you know, even you coming in or your mom or dad coming to the dentist, first thing you walk in, you say, "Hi, my name is Dr. Vang," right? If you say, "I'm a hygienist, I can pull your teeth," what do you think? You say, "Oh, wait a minute." That's why my patients, you know, even they are poor, 70% of my patients MA. And everybody deserves a quality care. Doesn't matter. So I feel that we just don't want to create two-tier, you know, system saying, okay, you poor, you can see a hygienist, he can pull your teeth. Are you rich, you can pay, you see the dance. Even we do that, and I think, you know, I will support the OHP, but I will be supported with the supervision. Because right now my associate, he just graduated last year, I see a lot of sweat coming from him. A lot of sweat, yeah. At that time, you know, the patients are bleeding, the patients are frustrating. I don't want him. I saw that a few times. And a few times, he just left a root tip with the patient. They come back about a couple of days later with a swelling, you took the x-ray, there's a root tip right there. So I think it's very important that supervision is the number one concern. Even I'm poor, I should deserve quality care. So I really support the supervision and the type of quality of education. So like I say, 10 years I see over 20,000 patients, so I know how they want it. Even they are poor, they don't have money, they deserve a quality care. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Scuzzetto.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Dominic Scuzzetto. I'm representing the Minnesota Dental Association, and if it pleases the chair, I think we're going to be within our time limit, so I hope that gets to some points. Last year, we were here debating something called the Advanced Dental Hygiene Practitioner, and as you know, the Dental Association was very, very much opposed to that, primarily based on some of the concerns that you've already heard. We're back today debating something called the Oral Health Practitioner, which is basically the same proposal as we see it. What's different this year, though, is that the Dental Association, along with the subtle urging of our dental school, has come back with its own proposal for a dental therapist. And I want to call your attention to the fact that this is the first dental association in the country that's come forth supporting some sort of a mid-level practitioner. And we've put a lot of time and consideration into it, and we've done it for a couple of reasons. One, because we're concerned about access to care, and two, because the program, the OHP program, is not satisfactory. It's too broad. We have very considerable concerns about the training that can be provided, and we think that under the current proposal, it lacks adequate supervision. Another issue is the question of cost containment, and I think you all know that the dental program under the governor's budget is being emasculated, and we're very concerned about that, and we're trying to save as much money as we can to maintain as many services as possible. And I would offer to you the suggestion that this is not as cost-effective as you might think. Keep in mind, we're going to be setting up someone without supervision in an office with a very limited scope of practice related to extractions and simple restorations. Not everything is simple. Not all extractions are easy. If there are emergencies, if there is a situation where a person reaches the point in their scope of practice where they can no longer continue, they put on the stainless steel crown or a temporary filling, and that's fine, but then that person has to go on to a dentist. So they need the travel expenses and the expenses of going to the dentist. So in essence, to take care of one procedure, you've had two practitioners and two visits. And I offer to you that's not necessarily cost-effective. The proposal that we have brought forth has the dentist in the facility, which would eliminate the need for the second appointment where all dental care could be taken. The practitioner could work up to their scope of practice and have the backup with the dentist present. And we think that is a superior model, and we encourage you to vote for that proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Spicetto. We'll have Representative Powell come back up to the table, and we'll have some time for questions. And if the members have questions for folks who have testified, we'll just have them come back to the witness table as well.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, I believe Representative Dean has an amendment, and I think if he wants to offer, I think we should entertain it and have him explain and then get some remarks.
Thank you, Representative Powell. Do members have questions before we take on the amendment, or would you like to move the amendment? Would you like to begin with that? That's so nice of you, Representative Abler. Representative Bunn, I know, has some questions, so I think we'd like to go to questions first, if that's
fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Howe. First of all, there seems to be three major areas of differences of opinion between the two approaches. One is whether the new mid-level practitioner should be involved in diagnosis and treatment as opposed to just evaluation and data collection type activities. Secondly, whether there is sufficient additional benefit from training alongside, you know, future dentist students in a dental school setting versus other types of educational settings with other aspects of the dental professions. And thirdly, and probably most importantly, the issue of safety for the patients. And then that breaks down into kind of two areas, one having to do with indirect versus direct supervision, and then also the scope of the procedures and whether the adult and also surgical things are involved. It's a couple things struck me, and I'm going to start at the end of that discussion about the issue of supervision. One is the point was made about many of the other places in the world where we have the mid-level practitioners, including in the New Zealand model that's actually talked about in our report from the health department, is that it's primarily focused on children. And I think the issues of safety, the difficulty of extractions, the kinds of dual morbidities that might occur, are obviously of much less likelihood with the pediatric population. Here we're talking about not only a pediatric population with this approach, but also in particular some significant at-risk populations, the elder population with comorbidities, but also folks who may have not had dental care for some time and who therefore may present with more complicated cases. Given that point, with a second point here, about the lack, another point that was made is in Alaska, it was mentioned that there's some great kind of teledentistry going on with kind of more real-time transfer of both information on the patient but also imaging related to the patient to the supervising dentist. Moreover, Ms. Gershon from the Pew Center also mentioned the issue of real-time supervision. It might be in a distance, but it was real-time. So I'd like you to comment on, in particular, in looking at the bill itself in Section 22, Subdivision 3, that where the collaborative agreement is discussed, the different points. There's nothing in here that, number one, suggests to me that what's required is what already exists in the Alaska model, that there's actually transfer of images of the patient, so there's some real-time input from the dentist on examinations and review of charts before or at least sometime in the supervising relationship. And number two, there's no assurance that the general supervision dentist, even if they can be reached by phone or some of the mechanisms, necessarily would be able to receive information electronically. They might be at home, they might be on vacation electronically to actually view the image of in that kind of thing and have an actual consultation with the therapist. And so this to me is a significant deficiency if we're going to have indirect supervision for some of these things, the higher level procedures, particularly the most high level procedures in the scope, that we don't even have in this bill the levels of supervision that exist in some of the other models you described. So if you could comment on that, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, I think actually just to be clear that those countries are under general supervision. And while those examples of the type of consultation that are available are sometimes used, there's nothing that requires those to be used. And what's really important here is the responsibility of the supervising dentist working with the oral health practitioner, depending on the circumstances, to determine how much or little that person can do and determine what level of consultation is appropriate. There are definitely many of the Safety Net Coalition dental clinics that are very prepared with high-tech ways of staying in close communication. There are others that will use the cell phone or use other methods of consultation. And the way these relationships work, the supervising dentist will work with that oral health practitioner and say, these are the things that you're able to go ahead and do. If you encounter these things, you can never do them. If you encounter these things, you can only move forward if you can contact me and we'll talk through the situation and we'll authorize you to move forward or not. And this collaborative management agreement is very important because it will define what the oral health practitioner can or cannot do. And we have made it clear in the bill that supervising dentists is responsible for that care. They're responsible for the supervision and the quality that's provided there. And we believe that dentists will be able to exercise the discretion that they need. And I don't think we need to require in every possible situation to dictate how that consultation would occur.
Representative Fun?
Could you comment further about this issue and about the training alongside dental students? I know in many of these other countries, actually, it is alongside dental students, and in some cases where it wasn't originally, it now is, about how to, obviously, if they're going to go work in this collaborative agreement, that context one would think would be advantageous to be very familiar with the model and what they've gone through in dental for dentistry.
Madam Chair and Representative Bunn, first of all, if you look at what really happens currently at the University of Minnesota, they're not that education is not a parallel process where they're working closely together between the dental hygienists and the dentists that are trained there. So that is not how it currently works. Mm-hmm. And all I think I would need to say is the state colleges and universities train, I think, is that 80% of the nurses in the state who are very close team members with their physicians, and I think that they're well trained to enter practice and work well with their physician team members.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you. Just one more for now. The issue of elder care and particularly nursing home care, and partly I'm asking some of these because some of us are involved overall, or most of us, in the dental issues related to the larger budgetary issues this session. One thing that struck me about either approach was that, number one, this issue of the dual morbidities and that elder care situations may be some of the most complex cases and also require that greater medical intelligence than maybe that was referred to earlier. And secondly, that I don't think under either bill, when going to a nursing home setting, I think they both were aimed at only low-income patients for that one qualified for programs. And I would hope that there's some mechanism, if we develop mid-level practitioners with depending on their either kind of supervision arrangement, and I would hope that if we are trying to give greater access to nursing homes, that we work out some way so that everyone in nursing home, no matter what insurance or financial arrangement they're under, even if they're self-pay in a nursing home, that they could access dental care on the site and not have to be transported to a dental office for it if it was available on the site. And that seems to be a weakness with both bills. And so I'd ask the others to comment on that later as well.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Sandra.
The way the bill is constructed, if more than 50% of the patients at that site are on public programs, they can provide care to everyone there. Okay. So I think every nursing home in the state would be able to do that. And also, what's exciting about this really is, and what we condensed a lot of our testimony, but what's very clear from other countries that have done this is that you can really train the oral health practitioner and know what they can and cannot do. And the idea here is to get, if they're in the nursing home, they can triage, they can determine some things, they can provide treatment. There's a lot fewer than residents that will have to be transported to a clinic to get the kind of care that only a dentist provides. We're not suggesting that they should ever provide any services beyond their scope of practice, and part of their training is to know how to consult their supervising dentist and determine when they can go ahead or not. And I'd like to also defer to Dr. Craig Amundson to comment on that issue.
Dr. Amundson.
Madam Chair, my name is Craig Amundson. I think many of the concerns that are raised are very real concerns. I would say that I would expect any dentist that's involved in a collaborative agreement to have laid the groundwork to resolve those kinds of concerns. There are many people in nursing homes with significant disease and comorbidities. There are very many people in nursing homes that can accept dental care on a routine basis. And so, it's one of those things of ensuring that the managing and supervising dentist has put in place those kinds of things that deal with most common occurrences that a oral health practitioner will run into, so that they aren't out there sort of flying by the seat of their pants, but it's under the direction of the dentist.
Representative Bunn. I'll, you can tell me at another time the answer to this, but if you could explain to me later the financial arrangement for how they could treat all the patients in the nursing home, even if only a portion are MA, but you can tell me at another time if you'd like. Okay. Thank you, Representative Bunn. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I wasn't paying attention early in the committee when we were talking about the mechanics of how we're going to look at both of these two bills and vote on them. Could you just remind me of what we're going to do?
You know, Representative Dean, I think you probably were paying attention, and I think it's changed midstream.
Okay.
So what we're going to do is we're going to finish up this bill, and then we're going to move to Representative Norton's bill.
Okay.
It seemed, you know, it made more sense once we got moving. So I know, Representative Dean, that you have an amendment, and maybe you'd like to move that.
Sure. First of all, I have a question. Can I just ask a question and then before I forget it, and then I'll move the amendment?
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tallis, if maybe one of the testifiers could just quickly go over one of the two major portions of this, it's scope of practice and supervision. Within the supervision of this, with regards to liability in other states, not other countries, but other states. When we have mid-level practitioners supervised by physicians or dentists, the supervisor has a liability for the patient. Could you talk about the liability issues that have or haven't arose in other states?
Madam Chair and Representative Dean. Since Alaska is the only other state that we're talking about, but many other countries, I'm not sure if we want to have the witness come up. But in Canada, where there is coverage, liability coverage, there's never been a claim against the dental therapist. I want to point out in the bill that the dental oral health practitioners in the bill are required to maintain liability insurance. Also point out that dentists in Minnesota are not required to maintain liability insurance.
Madam Chair, my name is Craig Amundson. You know, I think in the medical world, the position that to me appears to be the most parallel is the physician assistant who operates with a physician under a collaborative management agreement, and I'm assuming that the professional liability industry has learned how to deal with that, and as this moves along, it will learn how to deal with the oral health practitioner and the supervising dentist.
Thank you. Representative Norton.
As the author of the other bill, I don't want to be too argumentative, so I'm just going to ask the question about the surgery part of this, one of the safety issues that I've had with this, and part of that has to do with extractions and the use of oral surgeons, and we did have one testifier. I know I received a number of emails from dentists who no longer do extractions, who refer to oral surgeons, and I had several horror stories about permanent teeth extractions, which is one of the reasons I've had the concerns I have for safety. So I guess I'm wondering how a OHP will identify if what's happening is a simple or complicated, and particularly if we're talking about the rural areas, if they get themselves in a position without the direct supervision, which is, you know, one of my other concerns that I address in my bill, if there's no direct supervision and they run into something that seems simple, becomes complicated, broken roots or bleeding or infection or what have you, are we going to be in this situation, which I think I heard someone describe, where there's a need for a dentist then and a second billing, and will we have to transport someone to another city or community if there isn't a dentist directly supervising? I'm wondering if you could address some of those concerns that I've had.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, my name is Craig Amundson. Those are real significant issues that I would expect to be worked through in terms of a collaborative agreement. A simple extraction is not a simple extraction, and any of us that do surgery sometimes find ourselves working harder at getting out of broken roots than not. As being responsible for a dental organization that hired young dentists, that kind of episode is not limited to oral health practitioners. It routinely happens. Fortunately, in dentistry, we are able to stop off in time midstream and move the patient to a practitioner that can deal with common complications or broken roots or ankylosed roots, things of that nature. At the same time, there are some exceptions that you can probably have some assurance are going to be relatively simple. I saw a patient last week that found her way to our clinic, and the only reason she came to the clinic was she couldn't get her tooth out herself. Now, anyone sitting around this table could have taken that tooth out. And so I think a training period, an acclimation period, orientation period, no dentist I assume is going to turn loose an oral health practitioner that they haven't worked side by side with for an extended period of time and keep the leash pretty short on those kinds of issues. And also be responsible, though, for what do you do when you have those common consequences that you have to deal with. And there will be patients who will have to move upstream to a higher level licensed person when episodes such as that occur.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm deciding what... this is really quite a panel of people we've had tonight on both sides of this argument, and maybe it's a dialogue. But it's just impressive to see the experience and the devotion of the people on both sides who are here. I want to remind my interest in this, which I think is the same as the interest of all the people who have come, is that we want to find a way to serve these tens of thousands of people who don't find their way into regular dental clinics. They don't go there for a lot of reasons. I've sort of practiced this 30 years as a chiropractor. They don't keep their appointments. In your world, you even get paid lower than your costs than I do for the services. You have hard costs. It's a difficult population to serve. And as I've thought about this for the last couple of years, my thinking has been, how do we find a way to penetrate the people's culture who are going to want to, who need the care? Because if we don't serve them, they're going to be in the ER with a draining abscess. Another tooth is gone, which is against the first rule you all have as dentists, to protect all the teeth forever. So that's the struggle I have. And I sort of reading the physician's assistants section, as I'm looking at that, and you would be very nervous to know what they can do. It's virtually anything. They probably can't do open heart surgery, but they can all the drugs in the PDR book, which you have learned, they can prescribe any one of them. They can do any procedure that any doctor can do virtually, who's willing to take responsibility for them. You don't hear many complaints. You don't hear about the advanced practice nurses. There's one across the table from me. When they first came out, the meetings, I think, were like this. And I think the world was destined to be ending soon. And actually, it hasn't worked out that way. And I think that the medical practice of our state is better for the presence of the advanced practice nurses and the physician's assistants, leaving the fully credentialed medical personnel to tend to things that are of the most severe and the most complex. And I did pick a side, and I'm the second author on this bill. Not a disrespect to the dental people who are here. I'm inspired by your testimony, and I'm so happy to see where you've come in the last year and a half. That's tremendous movement, and you're to be commended for all that. But I think that as this goes forward, it has to be practical and real. And most of you don't have room in your clinics to put two or three of these, whatever you call them, practitioners in there with you. And the people who you want to have come to see them aren't likely to go to your clinic in the first place. Because maybe you're not in the right part of town. You're in a nice part of town. I mean, you're happy where you're in town. But issues of transportation, issues of all those things that are going to weigh against serving the people that we are trying so hard to find a way to serve. And how many dentists have been on the thing tonight? 10 or better. Not one of you looks like you're going to sign up a person to work underneath you who you don't have confidence in their ability. And I was a first-year practitioner once, and I learned a lot since then. And people still came to me then, and they're better off for it. They're far better off for having seen me in my 30th year, I'll tell you that. But these physician assistants can give you the wrong drug that interacts with the other drug and kill you. But the overseeing physician has trained this person, and they've talked about it. I bet they started out doing two things in the beginning in their first practice. And I would suspect that the first of these graduates on this program are going to be given kind of a tight leash by this dentist who's going to risk their liability. It's in the bill. They're liable too, to oversee these folks in the name of serving people. Now that's, I think, a brave dentist who would do that, but I'm sure there's some already who are willing to do the overseeing. So the other bill's coming up, and this is a project begging for continuing dialogue between both sides. And there's not just both sides, there's 10 or 15 sides here. But above all, as we work through this, the votes will go where they go tonight, and we'll come out with some kind of a product or not tonight. Maybe neither pass, who knows, and then we'll have nothing, which would be a really disaster, I think. But as this goes forward, and the dialogue needs to go on, I think the Senate put both into a bill. Well, I think that was interesting. But I think that the key is a collaborative agreement, which has worked so well in the medical model. And if you build it on that, and then trust these folks that come out of that system, I think that we're going to be pretty impressed, and I think that we're going to be serving these tens of thousands of people. Under this model, I think 200 and 250 will be out in 10 years. That can make a dent. And that excites me. I mean, in 10 years is a good number, too. I mean, it's a start. But with the best minds of the U Dental Place and the best minds of the Scandrets and the emergency, the safety net providers and the devotion that's in this room about the merits of both these projects, if we can harvest that, this will be a session to look back on to be happy about and proud of. Never mind all the budget challenges. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Are there other questions from members? Is there somebody else who wants to join you at the witness table?
Can I just answer that question? Bob Brandjord.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please.
In regards to physician's assistants, there's a difference in that medical model. In my lifetime, I was chief of surgery at Fairview Regis Hospital, of all the surgery departments, from general surgery to OBGYN to ENT and oral surgery and everything. And the largest issue we had to deal with was the scope of practice of the physician assistant in surgical procedures. And that one thing that was different in a model there is that they're being done within an environment that is being enforced by the hospital. When they are in the surgery suite or in the ER or wherever, a nurse can then report that they thought this was too much or that or whatever. So there's another oversight that is not there in dentistry. And that's a big, big difference between a physician's assistant in dentistry and medicine. Very big difference.
Thank you very much. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'd like to move the amendment.
Representative Dean moves. Well, let's just refer to it as the A1 amendment. Does everybody have a copy of the amendment? Representative Dean, would you like to briefly inform us on what this is about?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, what this is attempting to do is to address the two major portions of the bill that I have difficulty with, which are some of the scope of practice issues and also the supervision issue. This will do is address some of the scope of practice issues from the upcoming bill and insert it into 1226 on page 13. Starting at line 7, and that's where the A1 amendment would be inserted, and it deals with the scope of practice issues, and also the supervision section is dealt with on the back of the page in subparagraph F. So this will allow me to vote for the bill, and it breaks my heart not to vote for Saitow's bill, so this might be a way that we can improve it, and also to, as it moves through the process, to allow both sides to work on the same bill, and this would be in a position that I and many others could, I think, support and vote for.
Madam Chair.
Representative Powell.
I would like to oppose the amendment. In the collaborative agreement, this does not prohibit supervision if the dentist so choose. And essentially the amendment defeats the whole bill. Essentially that's the gut of the bill. The reason why I think you need the flexibility is a lot of these dentists are OHP practitioner are going to end up at nursing homes or some facility somewhere. And if they have to take a direct supervision, a dentist to go with them, what's the point of the bill? So I would encourage members to oppose this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Chow. Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. Representative Dean, just a couple questions. First of all, can you explain the difference between your scope list and the one in the bill? And secondly, I wasn't quite sure, given it's talking about, refers to our rules, what you're doing in F on the second page in terms of the change in supervision, if you could just put it in the plain language for us.
Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, when you say, when you're referring to the scope of practice, pieces, which bill are you referring to? Are you?
I'm asking what changes does your amendment do onto the scope? What things were removed? What things were added? If you could just summarize it.
As you can see, there's quite a list within the amendment A1. If you turn to page 13 of Bill 1226, the pieces, there's I think about 40. Pieces of this. There's some several areas of overlap within the diagnostics and also the treatment. There's some pieces within this that will be directly from Representative Norton's bill, which are inserted into this piece as well. Extractions, the pieces of the bill that were particularly problematic to the people from the Dental Association are addressed with Representative Norton's bill. So we're just trying to bring the both of the pieces together so that all sides can work on from one framework and in moving the bill forward. Also, the definitionally, the supervision is not that is addressed in subparagraph F if it relates to the section of statute which is direct supervision and not separate. It's same site supervision.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you. Well, I guess in terms of maybe Representative Norton can explain too, but in terms of it's kind of hard for us on the spot here to go line by line to do the direct comparison, so that's why I was asking for a summary. In terms of the higher level procedures, does the language you substitute in here exclude even pediatric extractions, all types of surgery, all types of extractions? I'm just trying to be clear on what you're now excluding from your scope.
Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, from perhaps someone from the Dental Association can come through and interpret some of the technical aspects of these pieces, but from that would include non-primary, which is baby teeth. That's what would be able to do that, but not the permanent teeth.
Mm-hmm. All right, and as you're coming up to the table to answer the question, I'd just like members of the public to know that the amendment is being photocopied. It's not here yet, but it will be shortly, and I'll give you the high sign when it's here. Please join us at the witness table if you plan to help us answer the question. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chairman, committee members, I'm Patrick Lloyd, Dean of the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. Our bill is structured to permit the extraction of primary or baby teeth and not to permit either under direct or direct or general supervision the removal of permanent teeth from children or adults. And the placement of sutures. Those are the two singular, in quotes, defined surgical procedures.
Are there further questions, Representative Bunn? All right, Representative Norton, did you have a question? Thank you.
I didn't have a question. I had a. I would like to support this particular amendment. And frankly, if this amendment had been accepted earlier in the process or last year, we wouldn't be here today because this addresses the exact issues that I had. I don't think it kicks the bill at all. I think it makes it perfect. So I thank Representative Dean for his suggestion and hope you'll support this.
Let's vote, Madam Chair.
Representative Dean?
Just ask for a roll call.
A roll call has been requested. On the A1 amendment, Representative Dean moved to amend House File 1226 as follows. The clerk will call the roll.
Murphy.
No.
Powell.
No.
Abler.
No.
Bunn.
Aye.
Dean.
Yes.
Norton.
Yes.
Rood.
No.
With three ayes and four nays, the amendment's not adopted.
Madam Chair, I think we have had a long and great discussion, and I think the bill is probably ready for a vote. Before we end, I just want to let everyone know that this is not easy for me. One of the testifiers here is my dentist.
Dr. Drew. You're looking for a new dentist.
And so I've been having discussion with him for a while, and it is not an easy decision for me. So as we move ahead, I would like to see us improve the bill and make it better. I'm committed to that as well. So.
Thank you, Representative Powell. Representative Dean?
I'd like to thank Representative Powell for bringing this forward. It is a very difficult thing to bring folks together and to hear from all sides, and you're doing your best to do that. And my dentist is here as well, and his office called me this morning to let me know that I'm overdue. I have a stern lecture coming up, and you should listen to your dentist more often, Representative Powell. But I do appreciate all the testimony, and I know that folks here are generally interested in the best interests of patients and patient safety on both sides, and I hope as we move along that we can be working on one bill at the end. So.
Representative Rood.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I also want to thank you, Representative Powell, for bringing this forward. There must be something about people who go into dentistry if it's really their calling, because my dad was a dentist, and he was very happy. He was the singing dentist and was a very popular dentist in Bloomington. I have relatives, some of you know, who serve as dentists. They work as dentists in Greater Minnesota, and they have actually called me to speak of support of this particular bill. And I do appreciate that this, as we kind of grow and change and struggle with how we're going to meet the demands that are out there, the unmet needs, it's difficult. We are going through something now called high school redesign. I think we are going to be starting hospital and healthcare redesign. We already are in our committee. People may not be in the tundra here, but they may as well be. I don't think we are setting up a two-tiered system. I think we already have one. If you can afford it, you get it. If you can't afford it, you don't. So I really look at this as a step forward. I will also be supporting the other bill, and I'll tell you why. I think it is important that this dialogue continues. I am a nurse practitioner. I work very well with my physicians that I work with. And the key to that relationship is trust. And if this is going to work, you're going to have dentists who are going to be supporting this program, and you're going to have to work on building that trust. So I look forward to hearing Representative Norton's bill, and thank you again, Representative Hill.
And Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Representative. I just wanted to also add my thanks for you bringing this forward and all of us engaging in this discussion on this one tonight, and some really eloquent remarks by many of my colleagues, Representative Abler, Rood, Dean, about how important this whole area is for us to continue to discuss it in the future, and look forward to that.
All right. Okay. Representative Dean.
I just request a roll call on the bill.
A roll call has been requested. Representative Powell renews his motion that House File 1226 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy and Oversight. The clerk will call the roll.
Murphy.
Aye.
Powell.
Aye.
Abler.
Yes.
Bun?
No.
Dean?
Nope.
Norton?
No.
Wood?
Yes.
With four ayes and three noes, the legislation is passed.
Thank you.
As amended. Nope, not as amended.
Wow!
We don't share.
Okay, Representative Norton. Representative Norton, you knew her motion that House moved?
Moving.
Oh, I'm just one step ahead. Ready for the vote. Move that House File 823 be recommended pass and be referred to the Health Human Service Oversight Policy. And members of these two bills are very similar, and a lot of the issues have been brought up, and so I encourage the author to explain the bill, and if we don't need to repeat, if things already been said, we don't need to repeat what's already been said in the previous testimony. So, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm happy that you moved House File 823. This bill provides, in my opinion, a better alternative to the ADHD-OHP legislation, which was suggested last session, a version of which has been brought forward for you this evening that you just voted on, which was the solution to address the state's dental access issues. I am chairing this particular bill because I was concerned last session about the bill that ended up in our omnibus bill. It had not been moved on the House side, but suddenly appeared in a conference committee report and passed. What I had been told was, don't worry about this bill because over the summer, consensus is going to be reached and your concerns will be addressed. And so I went on faith that that would happen and anxiously awaited the reports and the conversation with some of my local dentists and some from the southeast area of Minnesota, only to find out that indeed the final product did not address the concerns that many of us have had. I will say before I move on, I'm also carrying another bill because I do believe dental access is an issue, and in fact, I was concerned about this during the Healthcare Access Commission meetings a year or two ago, and we tried dealing with them then, unable to get better reimbursement for our dentists at that time. And so there is another bill that I'm dealing with pediatric physicians, trying to at least help and make referrals to dentists early in their the early years when they see their young patients. And hopefully we'll have some luck with that as well. The three things that concerned me about the bill last year were scope of practice, patient safety, and supervision. We've talked about those quite a bit already today, so I'm not going to go into that any further, but just to say that, again, those were the issues that I had raised concern about last year that I was told would be addressed this summer and that simply have not yet been addressed. So House File 823 will create a four-year bachelor's degree dental therapist program and subsequent practitioners that would be provided at the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry, a national leader in the field of dentistry. The dental therapist would be able to provide a range of preventative and basic surgical procedures to underserved populations throughout the state, be supervised by a dentist in a way that ensures safety for the patient and flexibility for the worker. This bill is backed by the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry, the Minnesota Dental Association, is being considered by the Academy of General Dentistry, and I don't know where that stands, and the Minnesota Dental Assistance Association, and is consistent with the recently announced position on the Board of Dentistry. Requiring these new dental therapists to be educated alongside dental students creates a solid foundation from which to grow the dental team, and we just heard some really wonderful remarks at the closing of the last bill about how important that relationship building is going to be. Furthermore, the University of Minnesota is the only institution in the state accredited to teach surgical dental procedures. This proposal offers a very open educational track, where the ADHP-OHP proposal is limited to a dental hygienist with a Bachelor of Arts degree. This program would be open to anyone. Students out of high school could enroll in the dental therapy program and attend 4 years at the University of Minnesota. They would be taking training similar and often identical to that provided to dental students.
If a dental therapist chose to become a dentist in the future, the prerequisite courses that he or she studied to become a dental therapist could be counted toward a dental degree. The dental school would also offer a master's program in dental therapy where these dental hygienists that would be, where dental hygienists could be eligible for advanced degrees. The open BA/MA approach makes more sense than a program only limited to dental hygienists. Once in the workforce, this bill requires a dentist to be on site whenever a dental therapist performs a surgical procedure. This is just good dentistry and common sense. Dentists have encountered countless situations, and I mentioned this earlier in my testimony, on what they thought was going to be a simple procedure, but quickly turned into a dental emergency. I have a constituent who sent me an account of an extraction that became problematic. He's 6'4" and weighs 230 pounds, and he was absolutely exhausted and at the point of thinking he was going to have to do something very different. But finally, much to the patient's chagrin, I think, got the tooth out. But he was quite concerned and now refers his patients to oral surgeons for extractions for safety reasons. This new worker will only have a few years of training and may not be equipped to handle the multitude of problems that could arise. When a mid-level worker performs any surgical procedures, a dentist must be on site to help out or take over if the procedure of the patient's circumstances warrant it. In House File 873, we account for the paramount importance of patient safety when expanding access for those who need it, while expanding access for those who need it. Other groups in the legislature are trying to make this new dental position as broad as possible, allowing them to diagnose and perform complicated surgical procedures without a dentist nearby. This, in my mind, is unacceptable and the wrong way to expand dental care, well beyond the scope of practice for a nurse practitioner, as is advocated for the OHP model. Instead, this model is more like a physician's assistant model. We need a clear vision of what the position will look like and thoughtful planning to ensure that they truly allow more Minnesotans to have access to quality oral health care. We ask in our bill that we move a little more cautiously, I think, than the other bill to determine if this new worker fits well into the dental system, and we can always expand the scope of practice if this works well and is accepted in our community. We should be proud that Minnesota is blazing the way in this new area, but we need to get it right. We must create a new dental practitioner that is trained at an accredited institution qualified to teach oral surgical procedures and then supervised in a common sense effective way, ensuring Minnesotans get the dental care they deserve while strengthening and expanding the entire dental team. With that, I think I'm going to turn this over. I know I'm going to turn it over.
Dean Lloyd.
Good evening. Mr. Chair, subcommittee members, my name is Patrick Lloyd. I'm Dean of the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. I'm a graduate of Marquette University School of Dentistry with 15 years full-time experience in the Veterans Hospital and 20 years in long-term care. I appreciate the opportunity to speak this evening in support of the legislation introduced by Representative Norton that will improve access and reduce costs of dental care to Minnesota's dentally underserved citizens. I'd like to just take a moment and recognize this evening that joining us tonight are a number of our dental students, the next generation of oral health care providers. They have been involved in our process as we shared what has developed at our school, so I appreciate them being here this evening, and I'm glad you're here to witness this amazing event. I'm here representing the University of Minnesota and to share with you information about our dental therapy program. As the only dental school in the state and the only institution accredited to teach dentistry procedures, I believe we are uniquely qualified to educate dental therapists. But before I begin discussing our program, I'd first like to highlight items in Representative Norton's bill that are elements that we consider important in the education and practice of dental therapists. The emphasis of this bill and our education program is on one standard of education and one standard of care that the profession can embrace and the public can trust. I'll just make a few comments in the bill itself by line reference. In line 118, 1.18, we've identified the opportunities that a dental therapist could perform services in our communities. One, to work under the supervision of a Minnesota licensed dentist, that's specified under the section listed there.
two, practices and settings that serve low-income and underserved patients or are located in dental health professional shortages. And three, provides oral health care services, including preventive, evaluative, and educational services as authorized in the sections referenced. On line 3.15, we identify dental therapists as those dental individuals who were receiving their dental education as a therapist in a dental school or dental college accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation. We also indicate on line 3.9 that prior to being licensed, the applicant must pass a comprehensive competency-based clinical examination as approved by the Board of Dentistry and administered independently of the institution providing dental therapy education. On line 11.1, describing the limited practice settings, we've identified that dental therapists licensed under this chapter would be permitted and limited to providing services and settings for low-income and underserved patients or in dental health professional areas. On line 11.4, we identify by number the collaborative management agreement procedures that the dental therapist could perform under general supervision. These would be categorized loosely as primary dental care provider services. On line 12.4, under the scope of practice, we identify again through the collaborative agreement those primary care services that could be provided, moving from line 12.7 down to and including line 12.23. Line 12.24 identifies the procedures that would require indirect supervision if a dental therapist was to provide those. Those include the pre-treatment evaluation, a change of circumstances, the opportunity for intraoperative evaluations and diagnoses, and the assessment and the assistance during unintended or unanticipated complications of care. Line 14.18 specifies that the dental therapist would be providing at least 50% of their care to patients who come from clinics or in practice settings consisting primarily of those on Minnesota health care, those who are medically disabled, those who have no dental health coverage, or those who are from dentally health shortage areas. Finally, line 15.23 identifies in detail the kinds of outcomes assessments we would engage in order to discuss and determine whether or not the dental therapists have impacted on the cost of care, access to care, and the quality of services provided. I have two handouts for you this evening. One is a copy of the images from my presentation. The other is a collection of questions that I have been posed to, that have been posed to me as I've traveled around the state discussing our program with dental professionals and the public, along with the answers I have provided people. I hope you will consider these as a resource as we move forward with this legislation. I'd like to say a few words about how the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry has created its dental therapy programs, but first I wanted to provide an update on what we've done over the past year since the 2008 legislation was passed of a law creating a new member of the oral health care team. First, I and Chris Blue, the director of our dental hygiene program, were members of the oral health practitioner work group. We contributed to all the work group meetings, offered content expertise, expressed professional opinions, and voted both in person and over the internet as directed by the work group facilitator. Second, in preparation for our role, we organized visits to three well-established dental therapy programs, one in Canada, one in New Zealand, and two in England. Included in our delegation were four additional School of Dentistry faculty with expertise in restorative dentistry, oral medicine, pediatrics, and general practice. We also invited six other members of the work group to join us so that they too could get firsthand knowledge of how dental therapists are being educated and practiced. These site visits were organized to speak directly with program directors, faculty, students, and practicing dental professionals. We viewed educational facilities and studied the impact of each national health care system of the programs we inspected. Third, we convened University of Minnesota School of Dentistry faculty to contribute to the Oral Health Care Practitioner Work Group, and we formed a curriculum steering committee. Because the graduates of our dental therapy program will perform procedures until now only authorized to a licensed dentist, the curriculum steering committee established some guiding principles. The standard of care taught to dental therapists at the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry will be identical to that taught to dental students. The scope of practice competency requirements for dental therapists will be identical to those which apply to dental students. Examination, diagnosis, and treatment planning remain the purview of the dentist. We base this particular guideline on the fact that there is no published data comparing the examination, diagnostic, and treatment planning skills of dentists compared to dental therapists. Furthermore, there are no studies that have assessed the capabilities of dental therapists in conducting the kind of assessments that patients need who are medically compromised and have had long periods of time without receiving comprehensive dental care. Health promotion disease prevention will be core elements of our education program. Irreversible surgical procedures will be performed under the indirect supervision of a dentist, which means the dentist must be in the clinic. Our program will be structured to complement rather than compete with other dental professionals. Graduates will contribute to reducing the cost of care and to improving access to underserved populations. The education will occur in a professional environment which includes dental hygienists, dentists, to ensure graduates are prepared to work in a team setting. Graduates will be able to find viable career opportunities, and this program will be replicated or be replicatable at dental schools throughout the country. Next, the School of Dentistry created a curriculum steering committee to develop a curriculum which identified faculty to teach and train and determine which facility enhancements would be needed to improve such a program. The next two images on your handout include illustrations that show the distribution of time our students will spend in each aspect of their education. It's a progressive, basic, and applied integrated curriculum. We designed this curriculum to educate dental therapists not to what a collaborative agreement between an employing dentist and a dental therapist might authorize them to do. We designed this curriculum to train dental therapists to the full extent of what the law would authorize them to do. We will not train to the most common occurrences. We will train to the scope of practice and levels of supervision defined by the law. It is important for us to distinguish one dental discipline from another so that we could create a curriculum that would be complementary to both. We therefore have used these descriptors on the images that I presented to you to differentiate dental hygienists from dental therapists. This seems to be a language that resounds well in the community, both the professional and lay community, recognizing that dental hygienists use hand instruments to work on the outside of the tooth to improve the health of the gum tissues and prevent decay. Dental therapists use drills to cut into teeth to remove decay, special devices to place and finish fillings, and surgical instruments to extract teeth. We've developed two programs. One is a program for high school graduates. They could enroll in to learn to earn a Bachelor of Science degree in dental therapy. It would be a full-time program, 40 months in length. It would run year-long, so the academic calendar aligns with that of our dental and dental hygiene students. We will also offer a Master of Dental Therapy degree. It is designed for the adult learner, someone who already has a bachelor's degree and is wanting to make a career shift. It, too, will be a full-time program running continuously for 28 months. Neither of our programs requires training in dental hygiene. We believe such a prerequisite would significantly restrict the pool of potential applicants and would hinder our ability to meet our goals to help reduce the cost of delivering care. In addition to covering the same dental education, our Master of Dental Therapy program will provide coursework in leadership, public health, and education. Our graduates from the Master of Dental Therapy program will be prepared to assume academic and public health positions. They will be dental therapy educators and public health leaders for the future. Both programs are designed to help increase the capacity of the existing network of providers to care for more patients and not to increase the number of treatment sites. We expect the graduates of our program will have a significantly lower level of debt, educational debt, than other members of the oral health care team. This will reduce the cost of providing dental care once they are practicing. Our graduates will have a salary expectation at or below a singularly trained dental hygienist, thus creating a financial advantage for clinic operations caring for medical assistant patients. The legislation will also require that half of the dental therapist patients are on medical assistance or below the 200% federal poverty level. And to ensure that our graduates have the level of cultural sensitivity needed to care for diverse patient populations, they will be educated with our international dental students and enroll in coursework designed specifically for healthcare professionals serving multinational communities. Of the many things we learned on our site visits under other dental therapy programs, none was more useful than hearing dental therapy students at the University of Otago and Dunedin, New Zealand say that the most valuable component of their education was being trained with and alongside dental students. We will capitalize on this documented feature of successful dental therapy education by training our students in the same classrooms, preclinical labs, clinics, and outreach facilities that our dental and dental hygiene students are educated. Our curriculum is designed for students to learn together so that they can practice together. This will guarantee a single standard of care for Minnesotans. Our graduates must be well prepared to manage and care for patients of diverse backgrounds, including recent immigrants from non-English-speaking countries, places where healthcare delivery systems are not well developed, and areas of the world where dental care is suboptimal. The School of Dentistry prides itself on having experienced faculty with training to teach all aspects of the dental therapy education. By way of comparison, the position is modeled after the Physician's Assistant Program, and the most significant advantage of dental school-based education is that it has an ability to train the single standard of care, thus ensuring public trust and respect of the profession. So that you can appreciate the scope of treatments our graduates will be able to provide based on their education, I provide you with lists according to whether or not they are preventive, and this would include procedures or opportunities to provide dietary evaluations, caries risk assessment, oral hygiene instruction, application of sealants and fluorides, and oral cancer screening. Restorative procedures. This would indicate how our students would be trained to place restorations after teeth have been prepared. And surgical procedures. This particular terminology is intended to clarify for other healthcare professionals and the public the exact nature of the procedures our students will be licensed to provide. It is not a scare tactic. To meet the increase in number of students, we plan to expand our existing preclinical laboratories and clinic space. We will also need to recruit additional faculty with experience, knowledge, and interest in educating dental therapists. We will require additional financial resources for which we are diligently searching. We are committed to this program and moving it forward. The Board of Regents has approved our programs. We are ready with a curriculum for both programs and can begin accepting students for class this upcoming fall. I want to make a few comments before we move into the final session here. The School of Dentistry has been recognized nationally for the level of integration between its dental and dental hygiene programs. We're the only dental school in the Midwest that has a dental hygiene program. We're the only dental school that integrates the dental hygienists in the classrooms, the clinics. Our dental hygiene students and our dental students partner not only in practice at the Moose Tower, but they also travel to remote parts of the state of Minnesota to provide care at our Wilmer and Hibbing clinics. In reference to the nursing home issue that was discussed earlier, access is difficult not because of dentists' lack of interest, but because of the compromised facilities that are available in nursing homes. My practice for 18 years is based in a long-term care facility. I have firsthand experience in the difficulties of not only doing these health assessments, but providing care for institutionalized older adults. Fact, 12.8% of nursing home patients in this state take an anticoagulant. Fact, 48% of the nursing home patients in this state have dementia. Fact, a small number of nursing homes in this state have fully equipped dental operatories to provide care. I believe it's more the responsibility of the nursing home than it is of the dental profession to provide a way by which care can be provided in a more safe-effective way.
Dean, I got a question. I want to go back to, you said the school, the region has approved it and the school's ready to move forward. My question is, I know this is policy, does the university have the money to move this program forward if we were to pass the legislation this and you're given the ability to do it this summer?
Could you rephrase that for me?
My question has to go with Do we have the money at the university, at the U, to get this program running?
Well, as I said earlier, we will be seeking outside sources to support the program development, the faculty recruitment, and the facilities expansion.
Not state money, but outside.
We're pursuing all opportunities for funding.
So currently there's no money now. How much would it cost? I'm just curious.
Mr. Cow. How do you like that? Representative Cow, you know, sort of in higher ed, and one thing I do know about the university's budget is that the state gives them an allocation of money, and then it's up to the regents and the universities to decide what programs they're going to fund. So, you know, I think if the university and regents decide they want to fund this program, they'll have to do it within the budget that we give them.
Currently, there's no commitment, but there's a commitment to get the program going, but there's no commitment on the money part.
I don't think the bill's been approved yet, so I think they're waiting for us.
Okay. Go ahead, Dean.
You cut in right at the end of my show.
Thank you. We on the list, we have Dr. DeAngelis, and then Dr. Sled as well. Introduce yourself, and then you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Tony DeAngelis. I'm Chief of Dentistry at Hendrick County Medical Center. And first thing I would say is what a difference a year has made. There's been a tremendous amount of testimony tonight, and there's been agreement on two very significant issues. That one, we do have an access problem, and two, that we all believe that a middle-level practitioner can contribute to resolving that. I am at a location where access is 365 days a year, year in and year out. I also have faculty who work with MNSCU, the planning curriculum, and so forth and so on. And I respect them greatly. I need them greatly. We can also disagree, and we've agreed to disagree on some issues as well. What we're hearing tonight is two approaches to the same issue, access. And last year, the safety net jumped in first, and credit where credit is due. This, however, created enormous consternation and disruption in the dental community, but focused with laser-like intensity on access to dental care. However, given the direction in which it was proceeding relative to operating with a heretofore level of autonomy and scope of practice not experienced, it was only natural for it to meet opposition from the larger dental community. Now, having said that, there's been nothing short of a sea change by both the dental school and the dental profession regarding the role of a mid-level practitioner. Where 1 year ago there was nothing but opposition, I believe the profession has crossed a previously unfathomable chasm to accommodate a new reality. The university has come forth with an ambitious curriculum for training. The MDA has worked unceasingly to educate its membership about the unmet need of Minnesotans and how a mid-level practitioner can play a role in ameliorating this problem. However, I must caution you that this is but a small step, an important step, and not one in which we can afford a misstep. People talk about the fragmented healthcare system in the United States, I do not want to see fragmentation extended to dentistry. As I mentioned last year, what Senator Lynch said that this was about the patients, and it is, we run the risk of losing the counsel, cooperation, and care of the majority providers. People have referred to that as trust. It is a trust issue. The ultimate success requires buy-in by the majority. There is insufficient traction when the very group charged with determining and approving the educational preparation of dentists is marginalized. Some suggest that if you had to learn to swim, just jumped into the deep end of the pool. I suggest that we can reach the deep end of the pool in a more modulated fashion, which is offered in Representative Norton's bill and which has been echoed by others. You know, both the complexity and the size of the access problem is daunting. I acknowledge these are tough times for all of us. I came to Minnesota some 38 years ago, in part because it was a leader in healthcare and higher education. Although we may not want to admit this, we have lost the edge. We have lost the edge here. We were known for our leadership in so many areas, not just healthcare, such that the Minnesota model became part of the national lexicon. We always heard about the Minnesota model. It's time once again to put the face of innovation on our approach to serving all our citizens. And I believe that Representative Norton's bill will do just that. And I would like to just end with one thing, and it doesn't refer to this bill, but it's a much bigger problem. I agree that over time a mid-level practitioner will make a dent in the access issue. However, we are facing loss of adult dental care and loss of critical access to dollars. That will not only compromise access, it will compromise our ability to educate future practitioners, whether they be dental therapists and or oral health providers. And that is something we have to face.
Thank you, Dr. DeAngelis. Next, Dr. Sled, and please keep the comment to what we haven't discussed or talked about yet. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jamie Sled. I'm a general dentist in Maple Grove, and I had the honor to participate in the travels to the three different countries, Canada, New Zealand, and England. And I would just like to share just a few of the lessons learned from those trips, and I will keep it brief. One thing that we learned is that education in the dental school is critical. It's critical that the institution who's going to teach this provider be accredited to teach surgical procedures. It's important that the education is alongside dental students. Earlier this evening it was said incorrectly that dental hygienists are not taught with dental students. When we were in England, we had an opportunity to participate in one of their clinical programs and one of their clinical courses. You could not tell the difference between the dental therapy students or the dental students. The faculty did not even know which individual standing next to each other, which was a dental therapy student and who was the dental student. So it's critical from an educational perspective that the individuals are learning the same thing. The other reason why the education in a dental school is important, it's critical that we learn to all be a part of the dental team. It's not just a dental assistant or a dental hygienist or a dental therapist or a dentist. We are all a member of the same team, and we must all work together. And we must all be able to work to the level of our education and our knowledge and our scope of practice. So to learn together will give us the opportunity to work together and to complement one another, therefore providing better care for the citizens of Minnesota. And really, that's what it's all about. When we asked these dental therapists in the United Kingdom if they wanted to work on their own, independent of a dentist, without a dentist in the building, there was no question. They all said, no, we don't have the knowledge to do that. And we had the opportunity to visit clinics that were serving underserved individuals, where the dentist was in the building. And numerous opportunities, we saw that the dental therapist, who was working quite well with the patient, needed the assistance of a dentist, needed to have the dentist come in, take a look at the patient, make a new diagnosis and a new treatment plan, and then be able to leave the room and allow that therapist to continue on. But the therapist did not have the knowledge to be able to make those diagnoses. Dental hygienists in Minnesota do not diagnose. That's something that's very critical to know. Only the dentist makes the diagnosis. So again, to be a part of the dental team, to have this dental therapist really be an extender of the dentist, to give the dentist an opportunity to do more complex care where the dental therapist can work with the dentist
nearby if needed, that dental therapist can provide care absolutely safely, knowing that there is the dentist there to give help where needed. And one last comment on the Canada model. Again, we've heard, we are not Canada, we're not Alaska. But in one regard, I want to let you know that where the gentleman from Canada earlier said that 135 of the therapists were working in private practice.
Oh, ma'am, can we stick to this bill?
Yes. It's important that on this bill we're able to reach the underserved. And it's important that through the education and the supervision, we have the opportunity to reach out to the underserved with the supervision so that all therapists can provide care to those individuals of need.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Are there any questions from the members? I don't see any. Representative Norton, do you have a closing remark?
I do. Chair Cowan members, both bills that you've heard tonight are the first of their kind in the 48 contiguous United States. I've always wanted to say that. Thank you. I'm here today not because this is something I was dying to do. Many of you know I had concerns with the bill that was proposed last year, and I told you that today. But this is difficult for me because the senator that carried this bill, that started the bill in the Senate, was from my own community. So I did not undertake opposing her very lightly. In fact, I gave it the whole summer and hoped and prayed that the solution would come. But I'm still here today because I still have those same concerns, and you've heard what they are from the many people that have testified this evening. We are moving in the right direction. We are going to help, even if it's in a small way, with the access issue. And I would say you've already passed the other bill, so I would ask that you pass mine. Let's move slow and steady, but let's get the access right. I'd appreciate your support on my bill.
Representative Norton removed her motion. That House File 823 be recommended pass and be referred to the Health Human Service Policy Oversight Committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails. Bill is adopted. Thank you for coming. Adjourned.